Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series of Bruegel, the Brussels-based think tank. My name is Maria Demergis, and I'm delighted to host today's episode of the podcast, which is a special episode, not only because it's the first one after the summer holidays, but because I get the chance to introduce the new director of Bruegel, Jeromen Zetelmeyer, who's just arrived in Brussels. Welcome, Jeromen.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You were just about to start, actually, at Bruegel, and we are delighted to have you. And I think that our audience today would like to hear a little bit more about you, where you are coming from, your interest in Bruegel. And then I think it's important also to discuss about what lies ahead of us in what no doubt will be a very interesting season in the winter. So, Jeromen, if I may start with the obvious, tell us a little bit about who you are, where you're coming from.
Thank you, absolutely. So I guess I'm a bit of a pan-European product, so I'm a German citizen. I was born in Spain. I have family in both Spain and Germany. My parents were both in Spain at various stages of their graduate school work when I showed up. So I'm born in Madrid, where they were both doing their theses. And I've lived outside Europe for a substantial period of my life as a child in Latin America and Africa, as an adult in the United States. And that's actually where I come from now. Mm-hmm. So I have done a significant portion of my professional life at the International Monetary Fund with a long interruption in the middle. I think an 11-year interruption where I left the fund in 2008 to go to Europe, initially to London to work at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development in a very, very exciting time.
Indeed, 2008, one of the most interesting parts of economics.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I left Washington in the summer of 2008, and, you know, in part because things seemed boring. No, we had just had sort of the biggest disruption since the Great Depression to financial markets, and still the fund was not in business at all. So I thought, you know, better go and do something more exciting. But of course, then 6 weeks later, Lehman and all hell broke loose. But that affected EBRD as well. No, EBRD was really on the front lines of that. So it was great to be there. And then in 2014, I got a really unique opportunity. I mean, very rare for people like myself who are not politically connected and grew up outside Germany to join the Ministry for Economic Affairs and Energy, as it was called at the time, to be the Director General of the Economic Policy Department. So that was a political appointment. And, you know, I don't know how I got it, but it was really a great time. That was one of my most exciting professional experiences. So I did that for a couple of years. Then we decided to go back to Washington. And so I was initially at the Peterson Institute for International Economics as a senior fellow, which is sort of, I guess, a little bit of think tank experience that helps qualify me for this job. And then I decided to go back to the IMF for a while to do more practical stuff rather than research. And that's been very exciting.
So this is where you're coming from now. You're coming from the IMF.
Yes. So my last job was one of the deputy directors of the Strategy, Policy and Review Department of the IMF. And my responsibility was mostly to deal with sovereign debt problems and sort of external macro policy issues, more generally, you know, capital flows, exchange rates, and so forth. People have policy responsibilities there, which basically means kind of thinking about how the IMF should approach things. And then you have a sort of second leg, which is you are a so-called reviewer for what the country teams do. And that tends to be kind of an eclectic mix. So, you know, I had a really interesting group of countries. At the end, I had the euro area, which sort of counts as a country, even though, of course, the individual members of the euro area also have IMF missions and their own reviewers. I had the United States, which was super interesting, particularly in the last year. I had Lebanon, super interesting and very, very, very difficult, depressing case. I had Italy as one of the big euro area countries. And then for a while, I also had smaller countries like Haiti, for example.
Also very interesting.
So it was a very wide.
Indeed, very wide. But it's also very important to understand also the global scope here. So tell us a little bit about your interest at Bruegel.
Well, I mean, it's a dream job, right? I mean, it's Europe's premier economic policy think tank. It was founded by friends of mine that I hugely respect, Jean Pisani-Ferry and Nicolas Ferrand. I had very good relationships with the former director, Guntram Wolf. I think you have done a super job. And, you know, generally it is an exciting place. It's also, I find, quite unique in its internal culture. So it is feels very cohesive, very team-driven, very uncomplicated. I wouldn't say it punches above its weight, but it certainly punches a lot. Yeah, the output is pretty amazing. I'm still not quite sure, as I told you, I think, yesterday or so, how you actually do it. So I will find out. I will find out in the next few months. So I'm also a little bit terrified to screw it up, right? Because clearly there's sort of some secret sauce here. And if I don't quite understand it, then I might screw it up. But basically, it's a huge opportunity. It's a perch from which to influence the European economic policy debate. No, that's its mandate. And it's just great to be back in Europe.
That's wonderful. And Bruegel will do great, actually, to capitalize on your international experience, which is absolutely essential for trying and address some of the problems that we have ahead of us. So I think perhaps we can then move on a little bit on what lies ahead of us. And there is no doubt lots lies ahead of us in terms of economic challenges. Bruegel will be certainly trying to address and be part of the discussions at the very least on all the problems that come ahead of us. We are in the middle of an energy crisis. The macro outlook, and here your macro experience will be invaluable to Bruegel. The macro outlook does not look good. I'd love to hear, and also our audience, I'm sure, would love to hear your take on particularly how long that would last. And in fact, I think because we are a European think tank, I mean, I would love to hear a little bit more about your vision of Europe, if I may call it this way, but where do you see Europe?
Right. Okay, so this is very helpful for me because having only just, in a sense, returned, the one thing I'm not very good at is sort of the nitty-gritty of the Brussels policy agenda. So that I have to learn, except in the area where I work myself, which is sort of more on the fiscal policy side, fiscal rules and so forth, where we have, I think, an important agenda item coming up. But sort of going back to the question, so I guess you can say something about where we stand in Europe with economic policy challenges and challenges more broadly, from like a super high level and sort of a medium level. And anything below that, I'm not good at least not yet. So from the super high level, the really stunning thing is just how different the world is that we live in now from only 12 months ago, right? I mean, only 12 months ago, we still had a sense that, you know, inflation, supply shocks and so forth, you know, to the extent that they were noticed and they were noticed at the time would be transitory. I don't know about Bruegel or the European Commission, but certainly the IMF, in April of 2021 was forecasting inflation to be, you know, below 2%, I think, in this year. We still thought of inflation being too low as a problem. And now we have these incredible inflation numbers, which I certainly did not foresee. So a complete change in the macro regime. And then the, you know, big question is this transitory or permanent? I mean, we've argued for a while it would be transitory, so we better be careful about that, right? I don't think this is the long run, of course. I firmly believe in the credibility of the ECB over the long run and that we will be back at 2%, but it may be
prolonged. So it maybe might, not, absolutely. Maybe not permanent, but prolonged.
Prolonged, right? Yeah. You know this better than I. So this is one of sort of this big regime shifts. Then obviously the other regime shift is the war. Again, it completely destroyed our assumptions about what was possible in Europe and what not. And I must say, I'm sort of quite proud that we as Europeans, together with the US allies, I think reacted quite nimbly to that and came together quite quickly. And, you know, my own country, Germany, obviously had an important role there and also maybe a more difficult task because undertaking this shift required questioning or revisiting the underlying foreign policy assumptions of Germany since World War II in a more fundamental way, a much more fundamental way than other countries. And, you know, we were criticized for being a bit hesitant, but I think the shift has been quite impressive. And while there's always potential for messing things up on specific decisions, I'm pretty confident that we have converged in a new good sort of consensus where it is clear that we have to support Ukraine militarily in a way that would have been unthinkable in the past, and generally that we have to revisit our views on the importance of defense, sovereignty, and so forth. So I'm very happy about this shift, even though the shift itself doesn't solve the problem, of course. So we actually have to follow through with it.
Can I ask you perhaps, what do you think are the one or two immediate policy challenges that we're going to have to address, also as Bruegel, but also as Europe, versus kind of more the long-term challenges?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the long-term and the short-term are all mixed together, but certainly by far the biggest short-term challenges is to get through the next winter, given the energy crisis. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, energy markets have been going crazy. The volatility is incredible. Prices have risen to incredibly high levels, and this may get worse. So I think the real question, and this, of course, is a subject that we will explore at Bruegel, and you know, very soon there will be a Bruegel policy contribution on exactly that topic, written by four colleagues of ours, Simone Tagliapietra, Georg Zachmann, Giovanni Scarabatti, and Ben McWilliams, is that the European response really needs to be coordinated on that. Otherwise, there could be a real disaster. There could be a disaster economically, socially, and not least politically, because it will benefit Putin. And by coordinated, we basically mean there needs to be a grand bargain where countries agree collectively to do things that from a domestic point of view, they would rather avoid, even though it helps them also from a domestic point of view. For example, Germany prolonging the phasing out or postponing the phasing out of nuclear reactors, of course, helps Germany domestically in the sense of contributing to the energy supply. But the point is that these types of decisions, or take, say, the Dutch decision to raise gas production, these types of decisions have pretty massive spillovers for other European countries. And so if you are sort of a country that's on the fence and then decides maybe not to do it because the political costs of doing it are just too high, you're really hurting the rest of Europe. So everyone has to be prepared to take some pain. But, you know, the point is that that alone may not be enough, because even if everyone is prepared to take some pain, in the end, the set of actions that we require to get through the winter may be much more painful for some than for others. So there has to be, I think, some sort of central, maybe you could call it compensation, not necessarily compensation for countries, but perhaps compensation for groups. So I fear that it may not be enough to just have a grand bargain in terms of policy measures, but that we may also need to add actual funds to the mix. So some form of common spending.
I mean, this is, of course, a very big topic, and we've written a lot on this, and no doubt we'll have to write more on this. But, I mean, just it would be interesting to hear your thoughts on this grand bargain, because whenever there is a shock, Europe is always asked to come to the rescue. And we've seen this, you know, for my liking, a little bit too often now, meaning that the shocks are really a bit very, very often. And of course, it makes economic sense to come together and have a sort of a coordinated approach. Think about the procurement for vaccines. No country would have done better, not alone, even the bigger countries, than we did collectively as Europe. Just that, which is a small thing in the scale of things. But now, again, in energy, we're coming together to solve it. It makes economic sense to come together and solve it, because that will ease the pain, certainly for some. But there are also complaints saying that, look, we have to pick up the cost. But actually, on the good times, on the good part of the cycles, there is no coordination of policy. And it is this lack of coordination of policy that implies that the costs when the shocks arise are very different between countries. And therefore, that we see the spillovers of those costs. So on this, while we have to coordinate when trouble arrives, shouldn't we coordinate also in the good times, such that the costs in the bad times are smaller? Is it not sustainable, or is it, to just expect Europe to come together and solve problems when actually Europe should come together and design the good times?
Okay, so I have two responses on that. So the first one is I absolutely agree with you that the best would be to coordinate in all times, not just in bad times. And also I'm one of the proponents of something like a permanent fiscal capacity or even fiscal union of some form in the European Union, as have been other Bruegel scholars before me, as has the International Monetary Fund that I just come from. But we all know that this is politically difficult. And so then the question is, what is the feasibility of ad hoc fiscal coordination in bad times? And so, you know, until 3 or 4 years ago, I would have been very pessimistic on this. And the reason is that we thought until 2020 that whenever a common shock hits, or whenever a shock hits that has common implications, even if it's not a common shock, it may hit just a country, and that the winners and losers would inevitably be the same, right? So, you know, the fiscally strong Germany would come to the rescue of the fiscally more exposed South, and so forth. And that, of course, is what really poisoned the common European well during the euro area crisis, that sense. Because, you know, the Germans did have a point that they bore a large share of the fiscal risk. One might say no larger, at least explicitly, than their share in the euro area budget through the explicit facilities, but implicitly perhaps a bigger share as sort of the fiscally most powerful country. But then, you know, something really changed because we discovered that shocks can be of a different nature. And so, you know, the pandemic shock was different. It was, first of all, entirely exogenous. And then, you know, the exposure to the shock had something to do with resilience of health systems, which is not necessarily correlated with other measures of economic strength, quality of policies, the willingness to be tough at the beginning. You know, some countries like Spain was the toughest, right? And early in the pandemic. And now we have yet another type of shock where suddenly it's, you know, Germany and some countries in Central and Eastern Europe that are far more exposed, as is Italy, unfortunately, but Spain is not, for example. No? Yeah. Spain is now the strong one. And so in that sense, I think that we are in a better place now to mount an ad hoc fiscally coordinated response, like we did very successfully during the pandemic. So I'm pretty optimistic that something common will happen, and the moment for it to happen would be the Prague informal summit, where, you know, that is really the moment where a common plan should be worked out for how to deal with the winter. Now the question is, will it be enough, right? And so that we don't know. But we're going to tell Europe exactly what to do.
I know that you've written on this, so I'm sure we're going to talk about this.
More our energy experts, right? And yeah, on fiscal rules, yes, we will also have something to.
But the trouble is that you don't know the nature of the next shock. I mean, you know, financial and fiscal shock for 10 years ago, 15 years ago, then health shock, now an energy shock. You know, God knows what the next shock will be like. It's not necessarily helpful to try and think of that shock. What we need to think about is contingencies. I mean, and that's the bit that, of course, what I mean by good times is you prepare your house in good times for the bad times. Of course, you don't know what the bad times will look like. But what you do is you have a program of how you're going to address the bad times, whatever the nature is.
Right. And here, of course, the unfortunate thing is that even though the nature shock of the shock is different, even though the degree of exposure to the shock is different, at the end, you know, fiscal fundamentals really matter and how you can respond to it. And so to the extent that those are national, we do get, if you like, kicked back a little bit 10 years into the frame of mind of the euro crisis, that, you know, some countries are in that sense more vulnerable. So sort of, you know, one of my big concerns, apart from energy and getting through the winter, is whether this combination of the energy shock and the need to reduce high inflation, which, you know, in my view, as in yours, should basically means that the ECB needs to prioritize a monetary policy normalization, even at the risk of triggering a recession, which we're not forecasting at this point, but which is certainly in the cards in a technical sense. It's already happened in the US, and consumer indicators are not encouraging. So all the combination of these things, energy, inflation reduction, tight monetary policy, and so forth, could have potentially adverse implications for the more fiscally vulnerable countries.
Absolutely. And in Europe, the extra dimension, and if we can come a little bit to the monetary side of macro, on top of all the problems that other countries have, other geographies have as well, which is that you have inflation, but it's not the good inflation. What I mean by that is it doesn't necessarily reflect the bubbly economy. It reflects a supply shock, which, of course, monetary policy cannot do much about. On top of that, we have the architectural parts in the Eurozone, which, you know, you have 19 sovereigns. And, of course, you have the threat of financial fragmentation, which is imminent now if we're going to see what you call the normalization. I mean, whether we like it or not, we will see some discrepancies in interest rates, in the risk premium for the countries, which reflect the underlying.
Yeah, we have seen. Yeah. And on top of that, we have an election coming up in Italy, which will add its own risks. So that is indeed a source of great worry. And so in that sense, I'm glad. I think it was a good idea for the ECB to come up with its so-called transmission protection instrument. Mm-hmm. No, the terminology is a little bit tortured, but that's almost always the case with ECB facilities.
Yeah. Sure, with new stuff. Yeah.
I mean, there is a bit of an issue of, you know, was this really needed? Did not the ECB already have an instrument for this, which is the OMT? And so we'll write about this.
And we have.
And we have, of course. But specifically on the TPI, I think there's more to be said. And we'll say it very, very shortly. Very broadly, sort of my view on that is that there is room, I think, for an instrument that, in a sense, trades off exposed and ex-ante conditionality, right? So the OMT takes everyone in, right? In that sense, it's unconditional ex-ante, but imposes heavy conditionality exposed through an ESM-supported adjustment program. And this is a way of, in a sense, getting more serious on ex-ante conditionality by putting down these four criteria that must be satisfied, but is light or actually does not have exposed conditionality. So I think this makes complete sense because it enables you to help a particular group of countries that would simply not want an ESM program. But, you know, the really critical question is the credibility of those ex-ante conditions, right? And so here I also have sympathies with some of the German critics that are worried that these ex-ante conditions in the end, when push comes to shove, might not be taken seriously enough, and particularly the one on fiscal sustainability, which, to its credit, the ECB has pointed to, actually explicitly named three institutions, right? The European Stability Mechanism, the European Commission, and the International Monetary Fund, that would be heard, in a sense, that would be reflected in the assessment of fiscal sustainability. But ultimately, of course, the decision in that announcement is that the ECB itself is what matters in that assessment.
Do you think that's the right way around? The political economy considerations behind that is that?
So I'm torn on that. So yeah. I understand why the ECB did this. They do not want to be held hostage to an outside process that they cannot be controlled. They may even feel that this, to some extent, infringes on their independence. But from a contract theory, from an economic perspective, there is an issue that if you have an instrument that is supposed to be and has a clear economic rationale in a very narrow set of conditions, but when used outside that narrow set of conditions, can undermine the mandate of the ECB, then you really want strong commitment devices that keep it narrow. And so this ambiguity that ultimately it's the ECB judgment, I think makes many uncomfortable, including myself. But as I said, I'm torn, and I was really pleased with the fact that the ECB explicitly stated that it would look to the debt sustainability analyses of other institutions. I think it would be very difficult for the ECB to actually use the instrument if the Commission, the IMF, and the ESM say this is a high-risk country, right? So in that sense, I think they did pretty well. And it's difficult for me to think how you could have done it better. But having said that, I won't commit to that because I have to think about it more.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we've toyed a lot with this issue here at Bruegel. And coming back to the architecture of failures of the of IMU, because by definition, we have architecture of failures. In the principal agent, straightforward theories, we still don't know who is the principal to the agent called the ECB. And this generates political economy problems, and which actually, you know, you are torn about this because we are moving in the direction where the agent actually kind of ignores the principal. But of course, if we don't know who the principal is,
yes. Well, I mean, here, let me be Germanic, right? So the principle is the legal framework, the mandate, right? So there is, in some sense, an abstract principle reflecting a political consensus or at least a political negotiation at the time of the Maastricht Treaty that wanted the institution to function in a particular way. It was heavily influenced by Germany, but not only. And so I think that's the hard constraint, right? And then I think that subject to the constraint, you can do a lot. I mean, the ECB has been extremely creative, and I mean this in a really good way, right? And taking a broad view while respecting its mandate. So I think it has it broadly right. The fact that inflation is high in Europe now is certainly something that is an issue for the ECB in the sense that one cannot completely absolve it of responsibility on that. This was not all exogenous. It was not all supply shock driven. Clearly, rebound from the pandemic recession, stimulus of various forms, monetary, fiscal, had something to do with it, but less than in the United States. And of course, it is a common, a worldwide phenomenon. So not something that a particular institution can be blamed for. On the other hand, this is supposed to be the most independent, most inflation-focused institution among central banks. And so there is an issue there, and they have to take it very seriously, and I'm sure they will.
I'm already seeing this. We're going to have a lot of discussions on these issues. But before we close our conversation here, I mean, I would like to maybe spend a few minutes thinking also about the long run, just by use of giving a little bit of an idea, the direction of travel, you know, the challenges, the geopolitical challenges that, of course, are, you know, many, and how they impede or they need to necessarily inform economic discussions, the place of Europe. I mean, you know, you will have no doubt many opportunities to discuss these issues. I mean, the role of China, Africa as a continent that we often forget in Europe. And of course, you know, you talked about elections. We're going to have also US elections pretty soon. You know, what are the risks in that respect? What kind of things keep you up at night?
Right. So it's, a two-sided story. So the one side of the story is that the external pressure is bigger than it was. The external threats are much bigger than it was. The size of Europe as a part of the world economy is shrinking. The ecological challenges are going up. We've had a terrible summer as far as heat waves and droughts are concerned. So the environment is just much tougher than it was for most of the post-war period. Then the upside is that a defining characteristic, unfortunately, of Europe since World War II, and this has to do with the political economy of the European Union and its predecessors, is its love for avoiding hard decisions, muddling through, postponing the necessary. So what I mean by that is that while the outside conditions are very difficult, there is a lot of room to improve on the coherence on internal policy making and the quality of internal institutions, particularly on the fiscal side, right? As we would say in Germany, there's Luft nach oben. There's a lot of kind of space to grow. And so there is a sense, you know, and this goes back to this old saying that Europe grows through crisis, that if the policy reaction, if the political reaction to these external threats is sufficiently strong, we might actually come out better. Because it really puts us, how do you say, on our toes. There is maybe a nonlinearity in the reaction that, you know, mediocrity, muddling through is no longer an option. And so maybe some really important things will come out. And the one area, of course, where we think we hope that this will be is in establishing a common energy market and a common gas market that is truly common. And the importance of that is that it gets into one area that has been notoriously the most difficult, right, which is the common market agenda. And so in that sense, there is an opportunity, right, a very important opportunity. And maybe in the long run, this will actually be good for European cohesion. And as long as the war does not get out of control, in the end, who knows? And, you know, and Ukraine emerges well from this war, we might actually look back on this and saying, well, this was the moment when Europe grew stronger.
Oh, well, I certainly hope that we can have a quick resolution to the war. That's the perhaps priority number one. And I certainly hope that we come out stronger. Jeromy, no doubt we will have many opportunities to discuss this and much more in greater detail. But for the moment, I think that's all we have time for today. I wish you a very good start to your position at Bruegel and looking forward to a wonderful collaboration in the future. This is what we have time for today. Thank you, listeners, for staying with us. You can find all of our recordings and all of the output that Bruegel produces at our website, www.bruegel.org. For the moment, I just say goodbye and I will see you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.